HackmanHackman.com on the bonus show. We'll see you then. I'll be back tomorrow. We start today with the good little Supreme Court. They're really being a good little Supreme Court for Donald Trump, aren't they? The Supreme Court is serving Trump, announcing that they will take up his claim of presidential immunity, which bolsters and confirms Trump's delay strategy, as this will push one criminal trial out further. The New York Times reports, in taking up Trump's immunity claim, Supreme Court bolstered his delay strategy by scheduling a hearing for late April on the former president's assertion that he cannot be prosecuted for his actions in office. The justices increased the chance that he will not face trial by election day. This was Trump's strategy. And by gosh, those three Supreme Court justices that Trump nominated are going to help him out. The Supreme Court that former President Donald J. Trump helped to shape, writes Alan Foyer, tossed him a legal lifeline last night, making a choice that substantially aided his efforts to delay his federal trial on charges plotting to overturn the 2020 election. By deciding to take up Trump's claim that presidents enjoy almost total immunity from prosecution from any action while in office, the justices bought the former president at least several months before a trial on the election interference charges can start. This is what we feared, and it is happening. There's an article in Salon by Thomas Mukasher, which says with the January 6th case, the Supreme Court could take America down the dark road to dictatorship. And there are two elements to this. There's the timing element, which by taking up a hearing on this issue in late April, they functionally and practically delay this trial from starting. If the finding is Trump's immune for everything he did while he was president, it also further generates a precedent which could be used to enshrine dictatorial authoritarian presidencies in the United States. Now, there is another practical idea that is being floated, which makes a lot of sense to me about this, which is the Supreme Court has justices there now, Thomas Alito, who could be interested in retiring in the next few years. They would like to retire with a Republican president in office rather than a Democrat, so that their replacements will maintain a right-wing court. As such, they are acting in a way to help Trump get elected. The idea being they are going to delay the criminal trial because they have seen the polling that a conviction hurts Trump in the election. By delaying the trial, maybe they help Trump get elected, which ultimately leads to their being able to retire, knowing that their replacements will be on the right. Here is Judge Luttig on MSNBC saying this is a big deal. The Supreme Court doesn't have to hear this. They're choosing to do this.
The state Supreme Court will hear Trump's immunity case.
Well, thank you for having me with you this afternoon, Nicole. I'm just hearing this moment.
I just heard it in my ears through
Look, this is a momentous decision just to hear this case. There was no reason in this world for the Supreme Court to take this case. The three-judge panel of the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia had written a masterful opinion denying that the president's claims of absolute immunity. Under the Constitution, the laws of the United States, there's never been an argument that a former president is immune from prosecution for crimes that he committed while in office. On the more practical level, of course, the Supreme Court is capable of deciding this very quickly in time that the former president could be tried before the election.
Right.
But today's decision makes that that much more unlikely.
Just explain that fork in the road. If they had refused to hear it, the appeals court ruling would have held, and the trial, Judge Tanya Chutkan could have scheduled her trial.
Correct.
Yes, and that's what I...
So listen, it's happening again, folks. We warned you about this in 2016. It came to pass by virtue of Trump defeating Hillary.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
They call it Super Tuesday for a reason. And otherwise, that there's never been one like this.
Millions headed to the polls on Super Tuesday. President Biden and Donald Trump appear headed for a rematch after both candidates win nearly every race. We'll get the latest with David Dayan of the American Prospect. Meanwhile, the Supreme Court unanimously rules Trump cannot be barred from the ballot over January 6th.
On Monday, the Supreme Court ruled that Donald Trump can appear on the ballot in all 50 states, despite his participation in the insurrection on January 6th. The decision was widely touted as unanimous, including by Trump himself, but it really wasn't. It was a deeply fractured 5-4 split that shows real divisions on the court.
Journalist Mark Joseph Stern says the Supreme Court's unanimous ruling is actually a 5-4 disaster. And children continue to die of hunger in Gaza as Israel continues to block aid deliveries to the north. We'll go to Cairo to speak with the best-selling author and activist, Susan Abohawa. She just returned from 2 weeks in Gaza. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Biden and Donald Trump appear headed for a rematch in November after both candidates won nearly every race on Super Tuesday when millions of voters in 15 states went to the polls. Trump's only remaining rival, former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley, is expected to drop out of the race today after beating Trump in just Vermont on Tuesday. Biden won every Democratic contest on Super Tuesday except American Samoa, where he lost to a little-known tech investor named Jason Palmer. Despite Biden's victories, many Democratic voters continue to show dismay over his support for Israel's assault on Gaza. In Minnesota, 19% of voters in the Democratic primary chose uncommitted. About 12% of voters cast ballots for no preference in North Carolina, as did 9% in Massachusetts. During an interview Tuesday, Donald Trump broke his silence on the war in Gaza by openly endorsing Israel's actions. He spoke to Fox News host Brian Kilmeade.
The non-committed vote that Biden's getting, they're not going to like you either because you are firmly in Israel's camp, correct? Are you on board with the way the IDF is taking the fight to in Gaza?
You've got to finish the problem. You had a horrible invasion. It took place. It would have never happened if I was president, by the way.
Over the weekend, Trump reportedly met with billionaire Elon Musk in Mar-a-Lago, one of the world's richest men. Trump's seeking to boost his fundraising at a time when he's at risk of losing much of his personal fortune. Last month, a New York judge ordered him to pay $454 million in a civil fraud case. In California, Democratic Congress member Adam Schiff and the Republican baseball star-turned-politician Steve Garvey are headed for a showdown in November to fill the Senate seat of the late Dianne Feinstein. Schiff and Garvey won the top two spots in California's closely-watched nonpartisan primary. Protesters chanting "Ceasefire Now!" interrupted Schiff's victory speech.
After all the travails of these challenging times without my incredible family, I also want to thank my brother Dan and my brother David, who is also here this evening.
Democratic Congress members Katie Porter and Barbara Lee placed third and fourth in the California Senate primary. Lee was the only candidate on the ballot who supports a ceasefire in Gaza. North Carolina's Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson has won the state's Republican gubernatorial primary. MSNBC described him as a Holocaust-denying, gay-bashing, extreme anti-abortion radical. The Human Rights Campaign said Robinson was one of the most radical anti-LGBTQ plus MAGA politicians on the ballot for making comments like this one from 2021.
The transgender movement in this country, if there's a movement in this country that is demonic and that is full of the spirit of Antichrist, it is the transgender movement. And this same people gonna tell me, you need to believe in global warming. And then they tell me, follow the signs. Follow the signs. You don't even know what gender you are.
Last week, Donald Trump praised Mark Robinson, who's African-American, saying, quote, I think you are Martin Luther King times two, unquote. In November, Robinson will face off against Josh Stein, who won the Democratic primary in North Carolina. In another closely watched race, Colin Allred won the Democratic Senate primary in Texas, defeating State Senator Roland Gutierrez and others. Allred will face Republican Ted Cruz in November. The World Food Program has accused the Israeli military of blocking the agency from delivering crucial aid needed to avert a famine in northern Gaza. Health officials in Gaza say at least 18 children have died from starvation in recent days. The Biden administration's defending its decision to keep sending arms to Israel, even though it's blocking aid deliveries. National Security Communications Advisor John Kirby was questioned at the White House on Tuesday.
What is preventing the president from communicating to the Israeli government that if they don't allow aid, we will not continue supplying weapons? Why is that not a fair trade? No aid, no bombs.
Because the president still believes that it's important for Israel to have what it needs to defend itself against a still viable Hamas threat. Maybe some people have forgotten what happened on the 7th of October, but President Biden has not.
Palestinians in Gaza say the lack of aid is leading people to take drastic actions to feed their families.
We have the willingness and ability to bear it, but is there a father in the world who can see his children reading in hunger in front of him and remain silent? Even if the price is risking his life, just like all these people who risk their lives in order to obtain what is not even enough for a crumb of flour or aid or canned food. Yesterday, some expired canned goods arrived containing mold and fungus. We are not animals, as they described us.
On the diplomatic front, negotiations are continuing in Cairo, Egypt, over a possible ceasefire. A top Hamas official said Tuesday the group will not release any more hostages until there's a permanent ceasefire.
We reiterate that what the enemy failed to achieve on the battlefield, he will not achieve at the negotiating table. The security and safety of our people will not be achieved except with a permanent ceasefire, the end of the aggression, and the withdrawal of the enemy from every inch of the Gaza Strip. Providing urgent and appropriate shelter and bringing aid to our people in Gaza is our top priority, and any exchange of prisoners cannot take place before all of this is achieved.
That senior Hamas official, Osama Hamdan. Israel bombed a home in southern Lebanon Tuesday, reportedly killing a Hezbollah fighter along with his wife and son. The attack came as U.S. Special Envoy Amos Hochstein was visiting Beirut, where he warned that a war between Lebanon and Israel would not be containable and could spread across the region. The World Food Program has warned the ongoing conflict in Sudan could trigger the world's largest hunger crisis unless fighting between the Sudanese military and rapid support forces comes to an end. Agency officials said Wednesday more than 25 million people scattered across Sudan, South Sudan, and Chad are facing severe food insecurity. Meanwhile, worsening violence has blocked humanitarian aid workers from accessing most of Sudanese communities experiencing emergency levels of hunger. Aid deliveries from Chad and to Western Sudan border have been halted after Sudan's Ministry of Foreign Affairs said there were concerns RSF fighters had carried out arms transfers in that border. Haiti's most powerful gang leader has warned Haiti is heading to a civil war unless Haiti's deeply unpopular unelected prime minister, Ariel Henry, resigns as a violent uprising continues to grow in Port-au-Prince. On Tuesday, Henry landed in Puerto Rico after apparently being unable to fly back to Haiti, where armed groups attacked the international airport Monday. Henry left Haiti last week for Kenya, where he discussed a deal to bring a U.N. force of 1,000 Kenyan police to the island nation. Haitian gang leader Jimmy Cherizier, known as Barbecue, issued a new threat to Henry.
If Ariel Henry doesn't step down, the country will suffer a genocide. If he doesn't step down, if the international community continues to support him, they will lead us directly into a civil war that will end in genocide. The international community, especially the United States, Canada, France, and the core group, will be responsible for all the people who die in Haiti.
To see our segment on Haiti, go to democracynow.org. On Tuesday, Doctors Without Borders announced it would scale up its medical operations in Port-au-Prince. The group said the recent violence has led to a massive number of casualties. The International Criminal Court has issued arrest warrants for two high-ranking Russian military officers for targeting civilians and attacking civilian infrastructure in Ukraine. ICC Chief Prosecutor Karim Khan spoke Tuesday.
This afternoon, Pretrial Chamber 2 of the International Criminal Court issued two arrest warrants relating to Lieutenant General Sergei Kobelash, Commander of Long Range Aviation of the Russian Armed Forces, and Admiral Viktor Sokolov, Commander of the Black Sea Fleet of the Russian Federation.
In news from Capitol Hill, independent Arizona Senator Kyrsten Sinema has announced she will not seek re-election this year. This comes just over a year after she left the Democratic Party, after years of shifting further to the right. Sinema was widely criticized by Democrats for voting against changing filibuster rules to pass key voting rights measures and efforts to raise taxes on corporations. Her departure paves the way for a high-stakes Senate seat match, likely between Democratic Congressmember Ruben Gallego and Arizona's former Republican gubernatorial candidate Carrie Lake, who supported Trump's false claims of election fraud. In other Senate news, New Jersey Democrat Bob Menendez and his wife have been charged with obstruction of justice in a new 18-count superseding indictment as part of a sweeping case centered on bribes tied to Egypt and Qatar. Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas is facing new controversy after reports he hired a law clerk who was previously found to have sent racist text messages. Crystal Clanton was the field director at the conservative student group Turning Point USA when she sent the messages, including one that said, "I hate black people," unquote. Justice Thomas has come out in defense of Clanton, who graduated from the Antonin Scalia Law School at George Mason University, which has long had ties to conservative donors and has maintained close relationships with Supreme Court justices. In a historic victory for college sports, the Dartmouth men's basketball team has voted to unionize. The players voted 13-2 to join Service Employees International Union Local 560. This comes as Dartmouth is seeking to overturn a February decision by the National Labor Relations Board classifying the basketball players as employees of the university, which granted them the right to unionize. In other education news, the Evangelical Christian School Liberty University has agreed to pay an unprecedented $14 million federal fine for failing to report sexual assaults and other crimes on its campus. It's the largest fine ever levied under the Federal Clery Act. And in Germany, a militant left-wing group has claimed responsibility for cutting off power and shutting down production at Tesla's largest electric car factory in Europe, which Tesla's hoping to expand. The factory could remain shut down for a week after an electricity pylon caught on fire. The leftist Volcano group took credit for the sabotage, saying, quote, "The factory contaminates the groundwater and consumes huge quantities of the already scarce drinking water resource for its products. Tesla is a symbol for green capitalism," they said. Over 100 people recently set up an encampment inside a nearby forest to protest Tesla's plans to expand the factory.
Hi, yeah, wir sind hier in Grünheide in Brandenburg und haben
We're here in Grünheide in Brandenburg and I've occupied this forest because Tesla, which is building electronic cars here in the Gigafactory 4, also wants to buy and clear this adjoining area of forest. We have occupied this forest to stop this.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
We begin today's show with the results from Super Tuesday, when millions of voters in 15 states went to the polls. President Biden and Donald Trump appear headed for a rematch in November after both candidates won nearly every race. Former President Trump defeated Nikki Haley for the Republican presidential nomination in Texas, California, and 12 other states. Haley beat Trump in Vermont, but is now reportedly expected to suspend her campaign today. President Biden won in all 15 states with Democratic contests. Despite Biden's victories, many Democratic voters continue to show their opposition to the president's support for Israel's assault on Gaza. In Minnesota, 19% of voters in the Democratic primary cast their ballots for uncommitted. About 12% voted no preference in North Carolina, as did 9% in Massachusetts. In North Carolina, Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson won the state's Republican gubernatorial primary. MSNBC described him as a, quote, Holocaust-denying, gay-bashing, extreme anti-abortion radical. The Human Rights Campaign described Robinson as one of the most radical anti-LGBTQ MAGA politicians on the ballot in the country. Last week, Trump praised Robinson, who is black, saying, quote, I think you are Martin Luther King times two. In November, Robinson will face off against Josh Stein, who won the Democratic primary in North Carolina for governor. Meanwhile, in Arizona, independent Senator Kyrsten Sinema announced she will not run for re-election this year and will leave the Senate after one term during which she left the Democratic Party after years of shifting further to the right. Super Tuesday was the start of the primary season for House and Senate races in at least five states. In Texas, Colin Allred won the Democratic Senate primary, defeating State Senator Roland Gutierrez and others. Allred will face Republican Ted Cruz in November. Many contested races were in California, and the primary race to replace longtime California Senator Dianne Feinstein, who died last fall. Democratic Congressmember Adam Schiff defeated progressive Congressmembers Barbara Lee and Katie Porter. Under California election rules, the two Senate candidates with the highest number of votes advanced to the general election. In this race, Republican Steve Garvey, the baseball star, came second, knocked out the other two Democrats. Garvey's a former Major League Baseball player, first-time contender, celebrated his victory Tuesday night.
Welcome to the California comeback. What you are all feeling tonight is what it's like to hit a walk-off home run.
Democratic Congressmember Adam Schiff was the front runner through much of the race, and he and his allies spent more than $11 million to elevate Garvey in hopes of beating his main intra-party opponents and keeping them off the ballot. This is one of the ads.
Democrats agree. Conservative Republican Steve Garvey is the wrong choice for the Senate.
Our Republican opponent here on this stage has voted for Donald Trump twice.
Mr. Garvey, you voted for him twice.
As you wrote me, and what is your decision?
Garvey is wrong for California, but Garvey's surging in the polls. Fox News says Garvey would be a boost to Republican control of the Senate. Stop Garvey. Adam Schiff for Senate.
Meanwhile, this is part of the concession speech Tuesday night from Congressmember Schiff's opponent, Katie Porter, who slammed Schiff's spending during the primary.
Our opponents threw everything, every trick, millions of dollars, every trick in the playbook to knock us off our feet. Yeah. We're standing 3-1 in TV spending and an onslaught of billionaires who spent millions peddling lies, and our opponent spending more to boost the Republican than promoting his own campaign. You gotta
be kidding. Also on Tuesday night, protesters chanting ceasefire now interrupted Schiff's victory speech.
After all the travails of these challenging times without my incredible family, I also want to thank my brother Dan And my brother David, who is also
for more, we go to Los Angeles to speak with David Dayan, executive editor of the American Prospect. His latest piece, The Intra-Democratic Battles Kick Off in California, Millionaire Self-Funders, Dirty Trick Tactics, Pro-Israel and Crypto Money Everywhere. The ideological sparring within the party takes a backseat to campaign shenanigans. David, welcome back to Democracy Now! For people who don't even understand what happened in California's Senate primary, that it's an open primary, if you can explain how the winner, Adam Schiff, the Congress member, helped to propel Garvey, the Republican, to be his opponent over his Democratic colleagues, Barbara Lee and Katie Porter.
Sure. In California, everybody, whether you're a Democrat or Republican or whoever, no party preference, gets the same ballot with all the same candidates on it. And then the top two, regardless of party, advance to the general election. Because of the size of California, money and name recognition are big factors. And what we've seen in a lot of races over the years since this top two primary has been put in place is that the front runner will try to pick their opponent. And in California, a very blue state, if the front runner is a Democrat and they can pick a Republican for the general election, then in a statewide race, they're almost guaranteed to win that general election pretty easily and not have to exert too much effort. So Schiff made a very concerted effort to elevate Steve Garvey. Steve Garvey did not run a single advertisement on his behalf. He did not campaign very much. Adam Schiff spent upwards of $40 million in terms of his total ad spend between him and his allies. And 60% of those ads mentioned Steve Garvey, or in the case of the ad you played, were entirely about Steve Garvey, including playing ads on Fox News saying Steve Garvey is too conservative for California. He voted for Trump. He's too conservative. The idea was to consolidate the Republican vote in California and use that to force Garvey into the top two, thereby boxing out Schiff's rivals, Katie Porter and Barbara Lee, and it was quite successful.
And David, California is also important in terms of the results of the House races for potential control of the House of Representatives. What did you see happening in the races for some of the congressional seats there?
Well, we have some very interesting results, at least preliminarily. The one race I would point to is California's 47th district. This is actually Katie Porter's seat that she vacated to run for Senate. And there were two top Democratic candidates and one Republican. And it turned into a proxy fight involving AIPAC. AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, their super PAC spent close to $5 million in negative ads against Dave Min, who's a state senator in that district. These supported Joanna Weiss, who is an attorney and a first-time candidate down there. And despite that onslaught, which is a really large amount of money for a primary race, it looks like Min is going to reach the top two, defying that almost $5 million in AIPAC spending. He's currently up by about 7,000 votes on Weiss in second place. And so it looks like Min's going to advance the general election. This is kind of a seismic result. We know that AIPAC is going to spend something around, according to reports, $100 million in primary races throughout the country this year. And the fact that their first foray, their first main race, they come up short. I don't know, every race is different. And Min was an elected official. He had won in that district before. But this is a pretty bad result for AIPAC in their very first attempt to influence the Democratic Party primaries.
And I wanted to ask you also about Alabama. There was a significant redistricting battle in Alabama's second congressional district. There were nearly two dozen candidates. How does this primary differ from previous elections in Alabama?
Yeah, so it was because of a Supreme Court ruling that they added this second plurality black district in Alabama. Before this point, there was only one Democratic member of Congress in Alabama. This was a second district, and as you say, it spawned a free-for-all, opened up people who lived 200 miles away from the district were running in this race because it was a rare Democratic-leaning seat in Alabama. What happened was there's going to be a runoff in April between the top two candidates because nobody reached a majority. One of them is a guy named Shamari Figures, who's the son of a state legislator down there, who was boosted by a good deal of support from the crypto industry, got millions of dollars of ads on his behalf from a crypto super PAC. I should mention that in California, in addition to this spending by Schiff, elevating Steve Garvey, Katie Porter was subject to $10 million in negative ads by the crypto industry, by a crypto super PAC. And the combination of that, you know, the elevation of Garvey for second place to box her out, and this heavy negative spending. I mean, practically all of the ads that I saw in the run-up to the election were negative ads against Porter or these ads against Garvey that were kind of too clever by half. So, you know, I think the crypto industry, we thought after Sam Bankman-Fried was disgraced and convicted that, he was the main funder of crypto super PAC ads in 2022. You thought that would die down, but no, there are other crypto millionaires who are spending lots of money to get their favored candidates into Congress.
I wanted to play a clip of the now North Carolina Republican gubernatorial primary winner. North Carolina's Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson winning the gubernatorial primary, MSNBC describing him as a Holocaust-denying, gay-bashing, extreme anti-abortion radical. Human Rights Campaign saying he's one of the most radical anti-LGBTQ MAGA politicians on the ballot for making comments like this one from 2021.
The transgender movement in this country, if there's a movement in this country that is demonic and that is full of the spirit of Antichrist, it is the transgender movement. And this same people gonna tell me, you need to believe in global warming. And then they tell me, follow the signs. Follow the signs. You don't even know what gender you are.
David Day and Trump praised Mark Robinson, saying, I think you are Martin Luther King times two, the significance of this primary victory for him.
Well, we've seen all over the country in past elections, Republicans nominate very extreme figures that end up hurting not just their own candidacies, but the candidacies of other Republicans. In these races, we saw it in Arizona last election with Blake Masters, very extreme Senate candidate, and Carrie Lake, the gubernatorial candidate, both of whom lost. We saw it in Pennsylvania with Josh Shapiro had a very large gubernatorial victory against an extreme candidate. So what tends to happen is that when Republicans nominate these real far right candidates, their rhetoric, their comments get elevated, and other Republicans have to answer for them. And I think almost certainly we're going to see that with Mark Robinson. He's going to be one of the more famous Republicans over the next several months, relative to Donald Trump, of course. And I think a lot of Republican candidates all over the country are going to have to answer for the comments of Mark Robinson.
And the significance of Senator Kyrsten Sinema saying she will not be running. She had been a Democrat, became an independent, famous, among many other things, for curtsying on the floor of the Senate as she then voted down an increase in the minimum wage.
Yeah, I think it's quite significant. Obviously, there was going to be, it looked like, a three-way race. Sinema had left the Democratic Party and became independent this year. And so it looked like there was going to be a three-way race between her, Ruben Gallego, the Democrat, and Carrie Lake, who lost the gubernatorial election 2 years ago, but has now come back and is going to be likely the Republican nominee. And in that three-way race, it looked like Lake had a bit of an edge just because you had two people, you know, on the center left side of the spectrum. Now it's going to be a head-to-head between Gallego and Lake, and I think Gallego has a bit of a better shot. And as for Sinema, I guess the private equity job offer came through, and she's going to move on.
David, I wanted to ask you a couple of questions about the presidential vote totals in the primaries. One is the significant numbers of uncommitted votes in Minnesota and a few other states on the Democratic side, but also the turnout. It seems to me, I haven't looked at all the states yet, but it seems to me that there was far more turnout among Republicans than there was among Democrats in several major states. Does that suggest, obviously, the question of enthusiasm among the both Republicans and Democrats as we go through this this primary season?
I don't think so. I mean, there really was no race on the Democratic side. Joe Biden's an incumbent. You had token opposition, you know, people like Dean Phillips who were running, but that race has largely been over. It's kind of true that the Republican race has largely been over, but you had two major candidates between Trump and Nikki Haley, and so I think there was more interest in turning out. And of course, Nikki Haley received, you know, she won in Vermont, and she received significant vote totals in other states. So, you know, the enthusiasm may have been coming from the Nikki Haley side of the spectrum to get out and try to vote. But of course, you know, Trump has kind of been the de facto nominee and now probably the real nominee if Nikki Haley indeed suspends her campaign today for a long time. And so this, even though I think voters haven't quite tuned in yet, and they don't really know yet that there's going to be a rematch of 2020. And whether that's something they want or not, it's clearly going to happen. But I wouldn't read a whole lot into the turnout statistics at this point.
And the uncommitted?
Yeah, I mean, it's quite a phenomenon. I mean, these particular uncommitted campaigns in Minnesota and North Carolina and Massachusetts really sprouted up in a week in the wake of the Michigan uncommitted vote, which had a little bit of money and a little bit of a campaign for several weeks. The fact that 19% of the vote in Minnesota is going uncommitted shows that for those, you know, that small section of the electorate that is showing up in these primaries on the Democratic side, a non-trivial amount of those people are really agitated by the war in Gaza and want to see the administration change course on what they're calling for. The administration has slightly shifted its rhetoric around a ceasefire, but really is asking for the same temporary pause in fighting and return of hostages they've always asked for. And so clearly there's continued discontent among a slice of the electorate, which could be, you know, have a major impact in November if they don't see results.
Finally, we have less than a minute, David, but the significance of one of the richest men in the world, if not the richest, Elon Musk, meeting with Biden at Mar-a-Lago this weekend could pay off what? All of his campaign debts, has referred to the Biden administration's immigration policies as amounting to treason. No, he met with Trump. Sorry.
Yes. It obviously the factor there would be if he writes a big check, Elon. You know, he certainly has gotten more and more interested in politics. He tried to influence the DA's race in Austin, Texas, where he lives, and failed spectacularly yesterday. Mr. Garza, the DA, Progressive Reform DA, won pretty convincingly in Austin. So he was unsuccessful in that foray. However, if he writes, you know, a $30 million, $50 million check to Donald Trump, obviously there would be significant repercussions from that.
David Dayen, I want to thank you for being with us. Executive editor of the American Prospect will link to all of your coverage of Super Tuesday. When we come back, as Donald Trump solidifies his lead, Super Tuesday, Supreme Court ruled Monday he can't be barred from the ballot under the insurrection clause of the 14th Amendment. Stay with us. Colorado by Milky Chance. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled Monday states don't have the authority to remove Donald Trump from the ballot under the insurrection clause of the 14th Amendment, which was written to prevent Civil War Confederates from returning to government. In the majority opinion, justices wrote, quote, states have no power under the Constitution to enforce Section 3 with respect to federal offices, especially the presidency, end quote. Section 3 of the 14th Amendment has never been used against a presidential candidate. It's only been deployed 8 times since 1860s. Trump responded to the ruling by thanking the Supreme Court.
I want to start by thanking the Supreme Court for its unanimous decision today. It was a very important decision. We're very well crafted, and I think it will go a long way toward bringing our country together, which our country needs. Essentially, you cannot take somebody out of a race because an opponent would like to have it that way.
The court's 3 liberal justices issued a concurring opinion warning the majority ruling attempts to insulate all alleged insurrectionists from future challenges to their holding federal office. For more, we're joined by Mark Joseph Stern, Slate senior writer covering courts and law, where his latest piece is headlined, "The Supreme Court's Unanimous Trump Ballot Ruling is Actually a 5-4 Disaster." He's joining us from Washington, D.C. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Mark. Why is it a disaster?
Thank you so much for having me on.
Your take on this is different from many others.
So, you know, this is a decision that's unanimous in name only. If you look at the separate opinions in the case, you can see easily that the court actually split 5-4 on one of the biggest questions here, which is how can the insurrection clause actually be enforced against candidates who have rebelled against the United States government? 5 conservative justices, as it happens, all 5 men on the court, reached out and grasped at this bigger question and decided that only Congress and Congress alone can enforce Section 3 against federal candidates, against senators, congressmen, the president, any other federal office holder, and that absent specific congressional legislation enforcing this clause, it just can't be done. The 4 women on the court did not agree with that proposition, and they faulted the majority for going way too far in deciding this case. Each of them pointed pointed out, this could have been done on far narrower grounds. The court could have unanimously decided that states can't unilaterally take candidates off the ballot under the Insurrection Clause, under Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. But instead, the majority couldn't help itself and went further. And as the three liberals pointed out in their separate opinion, what the majority has effectively done is insulate all oath-breaking insurrectionists, in their words, from ever being disqualified from the ballot in the future.
And how would you characterize the differences between the three liberal women justices on the court and Justice Amy Coney Barrett?
So, you know, the three liberal justices were pretty outraged by what the majority did and included some rather indignant rhetoric. I think entirely appropriate, certainly in line with the court's usual operations. Just, again, faulting the majority for reaching out, for going way over the line and answering a question that did not need to be answered. And by the way, also doing so in quite an ambiguous way. It leaves a lot of questions open for the future that the court probably should have resolved if it was going to go this far. So their opinion really read like a dissent. In fact, I happened to sort of look under the hood of this file. I looked at the metadata. The Supreme Court forgot to scrub the metadata. There is an indication that this was originally styled as a dissenting opinion. And at some point, very late in the process, it was changed to a concurrence. Still reads like a dissent. Justice Amy Coney Barrett agreed with the liberals that the majority went too far, but she decided to engage in some tone policing. She said, you know, there's stridency in the liberals' opinion. This is a time to turn the national temperature down, not up. So I'm not going to join them, and I'm not going to elaborate any further on my own disagreements because I don't want to inflame the nation any more than it already is in a presidential election year. So really a difference in style, not substance.
And in terms of the implications of this decision for those anti-Trump Americans who are looking for the legal system, either through this kind of a challenge or through the criminal cases against Donald Trump to be able to prevent him from actually running or winning a term as president. What's your sense about that?
So I tend to agree with the three liberal justices that what the majority did here was effectively foreclose any avenue of disqualification for Donald Trump or any other person who engaged in January 6th and then runs for federal office or seeks an appointment to federal office. I think that pathway is now closed. And the reason why is because I don't think anyone seriously thinks that Congress is going to now enact some kind of special detailed legislation that creates rules and procedures and standards for disqualifying Donald Trump and other insurrectionists from the ballot. Jamie Raskin, a Democratic congressman from Maryland, is working on it. There's some movement, but no one thinks it's going to clear 60 votes in the Senate. Turning to the criminal justice system, again, it's frankly unclear whether the majority thinks that Donald Trump can even be disqualified by the courts, even if he's found to have engaged in insurrection. So there's this statute that actually dates back to the 1860s that says if you are criminally convicted of an insurrection, then you are disqualified from office. That seems like it might meet the majority standard, but the majority does not say whether it actually cuts the mustard and leaves an open question, not one that's particularly relevant now because, for better or worse, Special Counsel Jack Smith did not prosecute Donald Trump under that statute for engaging in insurrection. Jack Smith made the conscious effort not to pursue that path. And so, again, I just do not see how Trump could possibly be disqualified from this or any future election.
Mark Joseph Stern, I don't know if you can answer this because it doesn't involve this particular decision, but on the issue of court's rulings and him having to pay up, something like $600 million now from dealing with the sexual assault libel case of E. Jean Carroll, over $80 million, over $450 million in that civil case brought by the Attorney General Letitia James. What's to stop Trump from going to get foreign money, like like his son-in-law, Jared Trump, Jared Kushner did, getting $2 billion from the Saudi sovereign fund, going to MBS or whoever, Mohammed bin Salman, to say he needs money.
So I think the answer is the New York court system has shown more integrity in prosecuting and dealing with Trump's various civil and criminal charges than the federal system. We have seen New York judges trying really hard to uphold and apply the law. And there are restrictions in New York on who can assist a defendant in helping to post bond. But they aren't restrictions that often come into play. You know, this law under which Trump was charged civilly, that he now owes $450 million under, it's not frequently used. We're sort of in uncharted waters here. And so I don't want to say definitively whether the courts would allow him to post bond with foreign money. What I will say is that Trump has a very sprawling financial network that he has repeatedly used to try to launder money, including foreign money, and sort of cleanse the dirtiness of it and then use it for his own ends. And I could very much see him doing that here. And I just have to say, I think it's very ironic that as Republicans on the Hill are scrambling to try to accuse President Biden of having some kind of foreign connection to his money, that he's going through his son to obtain dirty money from Ukraine, all of these unproved allegations, we know that Donald Trump's own son-in-law, Jared Kushner, as you noted, is obtaining dirty foreign money. And there is a very real possibility that he could help to funnel some of that money up to his father to help him get out of legal trouble. Father-in-law, thank you, to get out of legal trouble. And we may never actually know if it happens.
And, of course, President Trump also just met with the Hungarian Prime Minister, Viktor Orban. I want to thank you so much for being with us. Mark Joseph Stern, senior writer at Slate, covering courts and the law. We'll link to your latest piece. The Supreme Court's unanimous Trump ballot ruling is actually a 5-4 disaster. Coming up, we go to Cairo to speak with the Palestinian novelist and activist Susan Abu Hawa. She was just in Gaza. Stay with us. I was born in Palestine. I'm a Methodist. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. A UN convoy of food trucks trying to bring 200 tons of food into northern Gaza was turned back by the Israeli military today. A convoy of 14 trucks waited for 3 hours at the Wadi Gaza checkpoint in central Gaza before it was turned away by the Israeli military and later stopped by a large crowd of desperate people who, quote, looted the food, according to the World Food Program. This comes as Israeli forces have repeatedly opened fire on Palestinians seeking to get aid in northern Gaza, killing at least 119 people in the most deadly attack February 29th. Hunger has reached catastrophic levels in Gaza. The Palestinian Health Ministry said today the death toll from malnutrition and dehydration has risen to 18, adding, quote, the famine's deepening and will claim thousands of lives if the aggression is not halted and humanitarian and medical aid is not immediately brought in, unquote. Children, pregnant women, those with chronic illnesses are most vulnerable. Meanwhile, the Israeli bombardment continues with shelling and airstrikes today in cities across the Gaza Strip, including in Rafah, Khan Yunis, Deir al-Abba, and elsewhere. At least 30,700 Palestinians have been killed, over 72,000 wounded in Gaza over the past 5 months. Nearly the entire population has been displaced from their homes. For more, we go to Cairo, Egypt, where we're joined by Susan Abu Hawa, a Palestinian novelist, poet, and activist, author of several books, best known for her debut novel, Mornings in Jenin, an international bestseller translated into 32 languages, considered a classic in Palestinian literature. She's the founder and co-director of Playgrounds for Palestine, a children's organization, and the executive director of Palestine Rights Literature Festival. She just returned from Gaza after spending 2 weeks there, as now in Cairo. Susan, welcome to Democracy Now! If you can talk about what you saw. You have written, some are eating stray cats and dogs, which are themselves starving and sometimes feeding on human remains that litter streets where Israeli snipers pick off people who dare to venture within the sight of their scopes. The old and weak have already died of hunger and thirst. Describe your trip.
So that part of the essay is in the northern region, where nobody really is allowed to go. Trying to venture into the north is a suicide mission. There are tanks and snipers positioned, and anyone trying to get there is basically killed. As you just mentioned, aid trucks are not getting in either. They are intentionally stopped, and it's an intentional starvation, basically. I was primarily in the south, in Rafah. I was able to go to Khan Yunis and to Nusayrat and a few other places in the middle region, but that became increasingly more dangerous. I want to say that the reality on the ground is infinitely worse than the worst videos and photos that we're seeing in the West. There is a, you know, beyond people being buried alive en masse in their homes, their bodies being shredded to pieces, these kinds of videos and images that people are seeing. Beyond that, there is this daily massive degradation of life. It is a total denigration of a whole society that was once high functioning and proud and has basically been reduced to the most primal of ambitions, you know, being able to get enough water for the day or flour to bake bread. And this is even in Rafah. And the people in Rafah will tell you that they feel privileged because they're not starving to death while their families in the north, the ones that they can reach, because Israel has basically cut off, 99% of communication. What remains are basically communications by people who have set up some ingenious ways to keep internet in the north. But most people in the north have no idea what's happening. As a matter of fact, at one point, I'm sure you all know Bisan Ode, who is on Facebook. She explained to me, she often goes up to the border between Khan Yunis and the middle area in the north where you can't go beyond. And she explained to me that an aid truck that sort of pushed its way through but was eventually fired on, had people came up and ran up thinking that the war was over and people were returning to the north. So most people in the north are in total darkness and hunger and really have no way of communicating, no way of figuring out where to get food. And it's what we're hearing on the ground is surreal. I mean, it's dystopic. What I witnessed personally in Rafah and in some of the middle areas is incomprehensible. And I will call it a Holocaust, and I don't use that word lightly, but it is absolutely that.
Susan,
the stories
I heard
from people are... Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, yeah. No, Susan, I wanted to ask you, you write in your article, at some point, the indignity of filth is unescapable. At some point, you just wait for death, even as you wait for a ceasefire. But people don't know what they will do after a ceasefire. Could you talk about that? Even if there is a ceasefire, the level of destruction that the people face now in terms of being able to rebuild their country.
I mean, that's how much people have been reduced. I mean, the ceiling of their hope at this point is for the bombs to stop. And, you know, everybody wants to go back. They talk about pitching a tent on their homes and figuring things out. But a lot of people are trying to leave. There is a brain drain, basically. Those who can afford it, those who can raise the money, those who are able to get jobs elsewhere, who have professional skills, are trying to leave. They have children. All the schools have been destroyed. College students have nowhere to go. What's happening to people isn't just this death and dismemberment and hunger. It's a total denigration of their personhood, of their whole society. There are no universities left. Israel intentionally bombed schools and blew them up, presumably to ensure that rebuilding could not take place, that reestablishing a society cannot take place without the infrastructure of education, of healthcare, and basically foundational structures for buildings.
Susan, I wanted to follow up on what you said about a Holocaust, and you also use the term genocide. And you say genocide isn't just mass murder. It's intentional erasure. Can you take that from there?
Exactly. I mean, one of the things that Israel has been keen to do in Gaza is to erase remnants of people's lives. So you have, on an individual level, homes complete with memories and photos and all the things of living. And I'm sure you know Palestinians typically live in multi-generational homes. We're not a mobile society. And so these homes have several generations of the same family completely wiped out. On a societal level, you have Israel has targeted places of worship, mosques, ancient churches, ancient mosques. They've targeted the museums, cultural centers, any place that libraries, any place that has records of people's lives, has remnants and traces of their roots in the land, have been intentionally wiped away. It's really frustrating for us to read Western media talk about, you know, Israel's targeting Hamas and whatnot. They're not. This is always, and when you're on the ground, you understand this has always been about displacing Palestinians, taking their place and wiping them off the map. That has been Israel's stated goal. I mean, even in this instance and before, in 1948, it has always been their aim to destroy us, remove us, kill us, and take our place. And that's what's happening now in Gaza. It's what happened in 1948, in 1967. And every new Nakba, every new escalation is greater than the one before. And here we now arrive at a moment of genocide and Holocaust, because the world has allowed Israel to act with such barbarity, with impunity.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you also, you mentioned what the world's reaction. More people have died in Gaza in less than 5 months than have civilians that have died in Ukraine in over 2 years in the war in Ukraine, and Ukraine is 40 times the population of Gaza. I'm wondering your sense of the failure of the, especially of the Western nations of Europe and the United States to act.
The Western world has lost any semblance of moral authority, if they ever had any, or, you know, I think that maybe there was an illusion of moral authority previously, but I think, you know, what we have always known is that we are dealing with genocidal colonizers, but I think that is more apparent to the rest of the world at this hour. And I think what's also happening is that Americans are coming to understand increasingly, though not nearly enough, that they're being
lied to. And we're going to take up that issue in part two of our discussion, which we'll post at democracynow.org. Susan Abu Hawa, Palestinian novelist. Thanks so much.
WRCT Pittsburgh.
You will never find the more wretched hive of scum and villainy. We must be cautious.